Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Now, I want to get the view on the ground from the United States as President Joe Biden prepares to travel to Brussels later today ahead of that NATO summit tomorrow as the Russian invasion of Ukraine approaches the one-month mark. Marion McKeown is US correspondent with the Business Post and she joins me on the line now. Marion, all eyes on Brussels now as Joe Biden travels there. What are we expecting to happen? Because all of these sanctions are already in place. Do they have many more options left?
Well, you know, this is, I was just looking, they sent us out last night a detailed schedule for him, and he's got a lot of meetings and he's got press conferences and he's got, as you said, the EU Council, he's got a bilateral with the EU Council President and he's got the NATO headquarters and the G7. I think that a lot of this really, Claire, is more, it's about showing up. And of course, then he goes to Poland as well. And, you know, they're doing, for example, they're doing what they're calling the family photo with all the other NATO leaders at the NATO headquarters. You know, a lot of it seems to me that it's more symbolic, I think, than substantive. And, it, you know, again, we're being told that the president will reaffirm our ironclad commitment, their words, to the security of our NATO allies. So, as I say, a lot of it seems to be about, you know, reinforcing what Biden has been saying to Putin about he will defend every inch of NATO territory. As regards the Ukraine, which is, of course, the immediate and horribly pressing problem, it seems the White House, Jake Sullivan, yesterday, his national security advisor, did a briefing with us, and he said that they want to look at ways that they can A, introduce more sanctions, but also make the sanctions that are already in place more effective so that they, you know, that Russia can't find loopholes around them or other countries can't find loopholes around them. I think at the moment there is a sense in America, certainly, that the EU may be wavering, that this is now going to go into its second month and its commitment to sanctions and its commitment to a lot of things may be wavering within the EU, and that Biden wants to go and put on a really strong show of support of the NATO allies for Putin, but also to stiffen the spines, as it were, of the EU leaders and to say, you know, we've got to hold tight. We've got to stay united.
I'm just interested that you say you see that there are signs that the US maybe is concerned about wavering. Where is that coming from?
That's coming from within the Department of State and the White House itself, that they're feeling that, look, what America really wants, I think, at the moment, and Congress has been pushing Biden for this, they would love to see a total oil embargo on Russian oil and gas. Now, it's quite easy for America to say that. It imports about 7% of its total energy, oil and gas, from Russia. But for Europe, which it's up to 40% in some areas, that would be a much more difficult thing to achieve. But there is a feeling that if you know, the EU and the US don't go all in with Putin and really maximise the discomfort, that it will reach a level of acceptance. So I think there are concerns here. Biden is being also pushed by Congress. The Republicans started off being very much on the same page. So now they're saying, oh, you're not being strong enough. You know, you need to go tougher. And that, but for us, you wouldn't have blocked oil and gas from coming in. And but for us, you wouldn't have done other sanctions as well. And there's also talk now within the Biden administration, I know that the Pentagon is dead set against it, about finding a way that they could increase the military aid in terms of maybe finding a way that they could get aircraft into the Ukraine and to really listen to what the Ukraine is calling for, which is very clear. I mean, there'll never be a no-fly zone. That seems to be abundantly clear at the moment, barring something catastrophic happening even more. And I know it's hard to imagine there could be more catastrophe when you see the awful images from Mariupol and elsewhere. But it's, as I say, it seems that Biden is he's trying to strike a balance between, as I say, stiffening up the spines collectively, making it look and stressing that the whole of NATO is really united and that the EU and the US are also united on the sanctions. And as I say, just, you know, doing the photo op and the necessary press conference, etc.
So the symbolism of that, it just would be really interesting if there was a move, Marion, on the military assistance and the aircraft, given that the United States reacted with such fervour when the Polish British government asked to use the American base to supply the MiGs to Ukraine. That was just, there was a red line drawn there immediately by the Americans.
Well, there was such a misunderstanding there between the Department of State and the Pentagon, because Antony Blinken, who is the Secretary of State, had sort of signaled in talks, with the Poles and with, diplomatic talks, that that would have been a possibility. And then he was pretty well slapped down by the Pentagon on that. And it was an embarrassing miscommunication, really, because the US, there's always tension between state and Pentagon, always, in every administration. But they should have been on the same page on that, and they weren't. And I think there was a feeling, certainly what I've heard, was that the Polish government maybe was calling America's bluff a little on it, was the sense here as well. Whether or not that's the case, I don't know. And as I say, there'll be no revisiting of the no-fly zone, but it's possible that the aircraft are certainly more military hardware, because for the Ukrainians, it's frustrating. There's the US is drawing these sort of lines between defensive military equipment and offensive. And, the Ukrainians are saying, it's all defensive. We're trying to defend ourselves. So anything you give us, we're going to use to defend ourselves, because we didn't start this war. So I think a lot of the semantics and the fine line drawing must be frustrating for Ukraine. Mm. But whether anything will change on that in the next couple of days, I don't really see it happening.
Now, the US president mentioning the possibility of Russia using chemical and biological weapons in Ukraine. I think that was very chilling. It was reported all over the world. Yeah. How seriously is that threat being taken by the Biden administration?
Well, I think they're saying now it's possible and but not imminent. It is being taken very seriously, but also the talk, because one of the things that was discussed yesterday with reporters and with the National Security Advisor and the Department of State is they say there will be serious consequences, but they won't say what those consequences are. Now, that is understandable, I dare say, to a degree, but talk about serious consequences in case of chemical, biological, cyber attacks, etc. Nobody knows what those consequences would be. Would that be a situation, for example, where more military aid would be stepped up, where the Ukrainians might get airplanes, etc., from the United States? Or would are they talking about another level of ratcheting up sanctions further? It's just not clear. I mean, I remember I was on the Syrian border at the time in August 2013, I think it was, when the chemical attacks happened. And, Obama sort of wavered all over that and then sort of used the congressional reluctance to authorize strikes as a cover to do nothing. And I think there were, it's widely recognized that had America in the Bush regime initially when Putin invaded Georgia and then, Crimea and then, of course, Syria, that basically, there's been a pattern for the last almost two decades of doing nothing when Putin becomes aggressive. And I think there is a feeling that if something like this were to happen at this stage, that they really would have to take a strong response. But what would that response be? And I think that's the thing that makes people nervous and uncertain. But also a feeling here, certainly in the States and in Congress, that Putin cannot be allowed to continue unchecked, the sense of if he escalates this any further.
I want to talk to you also, Marion, about Ketanji Brown Jackson, who could soon become the first black woman in the US Supreme Court's history. She's 51. She's in the middle of going through the confirmation hearings. And I was having a look at it last night. She's been defending her record as a judge, her sentencing record, also her private practice, because she defended detainees at Guantanamo. How are the confirmation hearings going?
Well, today was grueling. I mean, yesterday, I beg your pardon, she sat there for 10 hours and she was grilled. And, there so much of this is pandering to various constituencies. And with the Republicans today, Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton in particular, they're looking for the QAnon vote in 2024. So they were asking her about, did she think Ted Cruz, of course, eloquent as ever, had a blown up cartoon behind him of a giant baby, which actually I thought looked more like him than a baby. But anyway, after his tantrum in Bozeman, I think we could we could justifiably accuse him of behaving like a big baby. But he said, do you think babies are racist? You know, this kind of nonsense that is pandering. I thought even the tone of the questions were insulting to her in some respects. They, you know, like, could she be fair as a black woman was the subtext repeatedly in them. I think Dick Durbin, as the judiciary chairman, could have taken a tougher line. But Josh Hawley has been beating this drum about her going soft on the possessors of child porn. It's something that was completely debunked, but he kept going on with it anyway. And then, of course, she was accused of saying that she her career is so interesting. We'll just talk about her for a moment. She grew up in Florida. Her parents were educators. Her father got a law degree while she was a child and became an attorney for a school board. She was just a brilliant kid. Obviously, from the outset, she was always class president, always champion debater, went to Harvard for undergraduate and for law school, graduated magna cum laude, editor of the Harvard Law Review, clerk for Stephen Breyer. Like, everything she did, she was exemplary as an academic, but also in her dedication and drive. And she then went on to become briefly a public defender. And while she was a public defender, she defended some of the inmates in Guantanamo Bay, which was, you know, certainly she'll be the only. She will be confirmed at this stage. I think we can safely say, just because Democrats have the bare majority, that it would be really shocking if she weren't confirmed. But she will not just be the first black woman judge. She'll be the first judge who was a public defender, which I think the court clearly needs very, very, you know, urgently, given the background of most of the other judges. So I think she seems... I don't know if you remember the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, which were so ugly, but where he literally just lost his temper in the middle of them and went purple. And, you know, her composure, I thought, was really impressive under some really unnecessary and provocative questioning from some of the Republicans. There's no questioning her credentials. She's abundantly qualified. There's no scandal. There's nothing. She's had an impeccable career. So we'll see how it goes. But as I say, I would be amazed if she isn't confirmed.
And if she is confirmed, it's not likely, is it, to change the ideological balance of the Supreme Court, because she's replacing a Democrat?
Not at all. There will be no difference. It will be a 6-3 conservative and deeply conservative majority for the foreseeable future. One thing I should just mention as a little bit of trivia, because I only found it out, she was Matt Damon's acting partner when he was an undergraduate in Harvard as well.
Right.
And, yes.
That's a great bit of trivia, Marion.
I know. I don't know. It slipped my mind, but it's just come back. But so clearly a woman of many talents. She didn't follow him into the movie business, obviously, but I think she's doing just fine where she is.
Yeah, I mean, she could have. She's very compelling. I was looking at her, you know, her face and her demeanor, as you say, in comparison to Brett Kavanaugh. She is really keeping her cool with a smile on her face as she goes through the 10 hours of questioning.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of it. Another strangely interesting minor fact about her is one of her uncles, Calvin Ross, was the Miami chief of police for a while, but she had another uncle who was sentenced in 1989 to life imprisonment in Florida for a relatively non-serious drug offence, and she became part of a sentencing commission, and she was one of the judges. There was a sentencing trend in America where if you were caught with crack cocaine, you would get a 3 times stiffer prison sentence than somebody who was caught with ordinary cocaine. And this was largely because crack cocaine became a problem in black communities in America, whereas cocaine was a problem of the wealthier white communities. And this was something she addressed on the Sentencing Commission as well. I'd say if we had time, we could talk through her whole career. She's had a really fascinating career compared to a lot of her colleagues on the Supreme Court, who basically did the very straight track and you know, ticked all the boxes and went to the bench. She did so also, but then she did some extra as well. I don't mean acting with Matt Damon. I'm talking about in the legal world.
Well, who knows what the future holds. Marion, thank you
Indeed.
So much for joining us. Marion McKeown, US correspondent with the Business Post.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.